Last week in our introduction class, the question was asked about, we were discussing reasons for mitzvot, and that typically the Torah does not provide a reason, and there is a bit of a debate about whether reasons in general should be given for mitzvot, and sometimes people do give reasons, and different kinds of reasons, and so on. So one of the questions brought up is that, well, the Torah does give reasons in certain situations, which would maybe imply that we should give reasons for mitzvot. And how exactly does that process work? So the Talmud discussed the example of Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, that he looked at certain verses where the reason was given, and it led him astray. Right? He said, don't take many wives, lest they lead you astray. And he said, oh, I'll be okay. And he ended up being led astray. So the question is, so what are we supposed to make of the fact that the Torah does provide reasons? So there are a couple scenarios where the Torah does provide a reason. Typically, when it does that, that is a situation where then that reason is meant to be interpreted, or meaning is supposed to impact the parameters of a particular mitzvah. But there is a difference between an individual stating his own personal assessment of, oh, that mitzvah doesn't apply to me for whatever reason. Meaning when, you know, the authorities study a mitzvah and say, oh, the fact that this reason is given teaches us that this mitzvah applies in this situation, not in that situation. So that's kind of a more objective distinction that may be drawn based on that reason. But when an individual just says, oh, that doesn't apply to me, that's something entirely different, meaning that's not necessarily true. Meaning it's not the significance of the reason doesn't apply to individual personal assessments of, oh, well, I'm so strong for that. Or someone who says, and this is then becomes a problem with, let's say, giving reasons for mitzvot. Let's say someone says, you know, the reason, I don't know, I've heard people say, the reason pig is prohibited is because there's some disease associated with eating pig, right? It's not written anywhere that that's the reason. It just says, don't eat pig. So some people give a reason for it. So then some people in modern times said, well, you know, nowadays we cook food thoroughly, so the things don't apply, so therefore, who's to say? Meaning, the Torah sometimes, if it just says a mitzvah, then it means that it applies. And even if you can surmise or, you know, assume that the reason, that it has a particular reason, for whatever reason the Torah chose not to give that reason, in other words, the Torah says, this is just the law. And sometimes that's annoying, because we say, yeah, but it doesn't apply, and doesn't matter. That's the way legal systems work. We're going to see that a little bit more next week when we talk about rabbinic laws and when the rabbis give reasons, when the rabbis don't give reasons for their enactments. And part of that is that in order for a mitzvah to have teeth, meaning in order for it to make sure that a mitzvah is followed, you know, sometimes giving too many nuances about when it's applied, when it's not applied, end up making the whole mitzvah unravel. And it could be that, you know, God is aware, right? The Torah is aware of that situation. And so even though, right, conceivably a mitzvah shouldn't apply in a particular circumstance, unless the Torah tells you it doesn't apply in that circumstance, then the law is still obligatory. Meaning the law still applies, even if maybe in that particular situation, the reason for that law doesn't apply. Right? And I think sometimes we feel uncomfortable with that because we say, oh, but if it's divine, it doesn't apply in the situation, then why should I? But the point is that it's a legal system. And, you know, person, you might say, oh, there's a law to give taxes. A person says, that doesn't apply to me. You know, it wasn't meant for a person. But you say, no, that's not the way the system works. Meaning, you might be right, but it doesn't matter because the law is what the law is. And if all of a sudden it was, you know, open to individual interpretation, the law simply wouldn't be followed by it, right? Everyone would do that. So sometimes, you know, a law is stated. It might be that the law really only makes sense in 80% of the situation, but it's still as, applicable in 100% of those situations. Unless, in this few situations where the Torah does give a reason, then sometimes the rabbis will interpret that, or sometimes the rabbis will, you know, give certain interpretations for laws that do make distinctions between when it should and shouldn't be applied. That being stated, there still was a whole school that said, fine, they may, the reasons may not have any legal ramifications, but it's still good to give reasons for mitzvot because that allows us to relate to them and to appreciate that God doesn't just say laws for no reason and that there is purpose in those laws and so on. But it becomes dangerous because then sometimes we can take those reasons and draw our own conclusions about when it should apply. And that second step is the step that within a legal framework doesn't work. Right? It doesn't work in that situation. Like any legal system, sometimes there's, you know, a law is just given kind of as a blanket law. And even though one might have argument why it shouldn't apply in a particular situation, too bad. That's the way legal systems function. And then certainly if a person then says, oh, but the mitzvot actually have deeper, you know, spiritual ramifications, so then for sure, you know, the law should apply. But even if you don't go to that extent and you say, no, there are real-life reasons for mitzvot, the reasons don't necessarily govern the specific scenarios in which the laws are applicable. Okay. I hope that clarified a little bit that question. Fine. So just before we begin tonight's class, I want to invite everyone. We're having a Friday night dinner. A dinner in the synagogue this Friday night. We're going to be having a guest lecture. He's written like 50 different articles about Lincoln, about the Civil War. He's going to be talking about Lincoln and the Jews. I think it's going to be a really cool dinner. It's going to be a lot of fun. If anybody's interested, sign up tonight when you get home. Go to www.csilearning.com and you can sign up there or call the synagogue office in the morning to make those reservations. It should be a lot of fun. Okay, tonight we're moving on. Really, this is our first class in our series. And we start with, where it all begins, with biblical law. We're going to be looking at Dinei Deoraita, Din Torah, the laws of the Torah. And we're going to be looking at the question of what do we mean when we say biblical law? Now, there have been Jews in history that have tried very hard to identify what is a biblical law, right? Particularly taking the attitude of saying, listen, I'll follow what the Bible says, but what the rabbis say, I can do without, right? And said that perhaps now, and that perhaps, and taking that attitude, the only thing that really applies to me are biblical laws, but what the rabbis said, that's what the rabbis said. So you know what? I say something different. What the Torah says, I'm willing to follow. What the rabbis say is a little bit of a different situation. We're going to talk about that next week when we talk about rabbinic laws. And what the why are they obligatory within the system of the Torah? But we'll leave that for next week. But within this notion of biblical law, certainly the most famous group that did this were the Karaites. It was a very large group. Some say in certain places it was the majority of the Jewish community were Karaites that basically said we'll follow the literal reading of the Torah, but when it comes to the rabbinic or the oral tradition, the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral law, as opposed to the Torah Shebichtav, the written law, that we're not going to follow. We're just going to follow literally what it says in the Torah. And sometimes that brought about leniencies, as you might expect, but sometimes it brought about certain stringencies. For example, it says you should not have any fire on Shabbat. So we say, well, you can light a candle before Shabbat, you can set a timer before Shabbat, and you can... They said, no, it had to be no lights on for Shabbat. They wouldn't eat any hot food on Shabbat. That's the Rambam quotes, therefore, a custom developed among, we'll call rabbinic Jews, to always make sure to eat something hot on Shabbat day. And that perhaps is one of the notions behind the chalent, you know, whatever it is. I mean, that was a food you could put off Friday that could be cooked on Friday, but then you could just keep it warm throughout and then have it Shabbat day. And the point was to show we're not Karaites, right? We're eating food that's hot. In more contemporary times, there's been movement. This was kind of more in like 19th century Eastern or in 19th century Europe of an idea that developed of Mosaic law. That was a similar kind of idea that also attempted to distinguish between biblical law and rabbinic law and tried to draw certain conclusions from it. I think we spoke about this in our history of halakha class, this famous case where there was a question about burial and whether burial should take place immediately, as was the practice, or whether after death, 3 days should... one should wait 3 days before burial, because maybe once I think they understood science a little bit, they then realized that their science was deficient. And there was this concern that maybe people really were still alive, though they appeared to be dead. Whether this is true or possible, people debate it, but that was the concern. And so there was a law passed that said you need to wait 3 days until burial. The Jewish community was up in arms. They said, our tradition is that you need to bury immediately. And there were those who went before the king to lobby to say, you know, that's not really what the Jewish law is. Why? Because what's the Jewish law based on? It says in the verse, in the context of putting to death someone who's been put to death, right? They've committed a crime. They've been hung. So the Torah says you should bury, you know, you should take their body down before nightfall and bury them. And so from there, the rabbis learned out that, oh, burial should take place, you know, right away. You shouldn't delay burial. And some countered, and they said, no, the context of that law was only in a case of capital punishment. But who's to say that besides for that, and the case of capital punishment, you knew they were dead. That was the point. You killed them, right? So there was no question in that situation, and that's why it was okay. But besides for that, certainly you shouldn't have to do that, right? And they called it Mosaic law. So, of course, the Talmud counters and says, if for someone who's wicked, we want to give them the respect of burying them right away, so much more so for everybody else, we should give them the respect of burying them right away. And so there became this whole school of thought that developed, particularly the Malbim, who is one of the commentaries on the Torah. So he engaged in this... it's really what his interpretation on the Torah is really about, of trying to show that rabbinic interpretation to the Bible isn't just, oh, a tradition, but it actually, if someone knows how to read the Bible, it's actually the only possible way to read the Bible. So you can just say, hey, I'm just going to follow what the Bible says, but if you really know what the Bible says, by definition, you're going to end up doing what the rabbi said the Bible says. So that's what his commentary is really all about, is showing, you know, the real way to read the Torah. In any case, so that was kind of that school. So the question for us is, and this is something we'll also talk about, is, okay, you know, but we do listen to what the Talmud says, right? We do listen to what the oral law has to say. So for us, what difference does it really make? Meaning, who really cares whether it's a din Torah or a din derabanan? At the end of the day, We're chayav, we're obligated to follow all of them, right? This is a legal system, right? And within the legal system, there's the biblical law and there's the rabbinic laws, and we believe that we're committed to follow all of them. We'll talk about that commitment a little bit later. But based on that, what does it really make a difference anyway? So that's something we're going to talk about tonight as well. But really the first question is when we talk about Din Torah, when we talk about a biblical law, what exactly does that mean? Right? Kind of that question the Karaites tried to answer, right? For us, what do we mean when we refer to biblical law? And I think the answer to the question may be a bit surprising to you. So we'll see that. So first, when we think of laws in the Torah, right? So the first laws that come to mind are the Ten Commandments, right? Which is kind of this interesting group of laws. The question is, at the end of the day, we also have this tradition that there's 613 commandments. I quoted here the source, in source number one, where this tradition is mentioned. This is source number one. It's in the Talmud tractate of Makot. It says, Rabbi Simlai lectured, 613 commands were said to Moses, 365 of them negatives, corresponding to the number of days in the year, counting according to sunrise, and 248 positives corresponding to the members of man's body. So right, there's 613, some are positive, some are negative. Said Rabbi Hanuna, where is there an allusion to this in Scripture? Meaning, how do you know? Throughout the Middle Ages, there was this interest in identifying what are the 613 commandments. And some of the greatest scholars wrote books devoted to this question of how do you define what gets in and what doesn't get in. And we'll see why it's not such an easy question to answer based on what we're going to talk about tonight. But the Rambam engaged in this. He has a whole book called Sefer HaMitzvot, the Book of Laws, which the whole purpose of it is to identify what are the 613 commandments and the parameters that he used in order to identify what counts as one of these 613 and what maybe is obligated but doesn't count as one of the 613. And there's debates among these different rabbis about what, for the most part, most agree, but there's, you know, a whole group of mitzvot that there is debate. They're not generally debating, for the most part, is this something obligatory or not. They're really just debating, is this one of the 613 or not. In any case, so where is there an allusion to this in the Torah that this should be the case? So it says in the Torah which Moses commanded us. Okay, it says, Torah tziva lanu Moshe, or Ashak ila Yaakov. Right, so the Torah that Moshe commanded us. The letters of the word Torah, number 611, right? Torah. Torah tziva lanu Moshe. Moshe taught us Torah. In Hebrew, there's a notion called gematria, which is giving numerical value to the letters. The numerical value of the word Torah is 611. So Moshe taught us Torah. Moshe taught us 611. And the two first commandments, however, of the Ten Commandments, we ourselves heard from heaven, right? It says, Anochi Hashem Elokech, right? I am the Lord. Right? God said, Moshe didn't say that. God said that directly to us. So the first two commandments, God said directly to us. It then says that Moshe taught us Torah. Moshe taught us 611. So you see, oh, there's a total of 613 commandments, right? And that's kind of the source for this idea that there's 613 commandments in the Torah.
Doesn't that mean that there, you could go through the Torah and find all 613?
Yeah. You can, but exactly how? But exactly.
Same commandments.
But exactly how you define the commandments and the Talmud is full of interpretation. So we'll see why it's not always 100% crystal clear. Okay, there's a lot of laws, but is that, do you subsume them under one category? Do you subsume them under many categories? Right, Shabbat, keep Shabbat, great. There's 39 different categories of Shabbat law. So do you include each prohibition as a separate law, or is that one law? Right. So that becomes kind of the question, figuring out these issues. How do you figure out what are the 613? It's not as easy as you might think. And they also have the constraints of fitting into this breakdown of how many positive, how many negative, right? Which gets quoted here as well. We don't have a book from Rabbi Simlai where he listed all 613. Okay. So, that's the source for the 613. So then the question really becomes, what's the significance of the 10 commandments? We have 613 mitzvot. What was the story with these tablets that Moshe brought down? So there's a couple different opinions. I don't really want to dwell on this. At the end of the day, it's not, doesn't matter so much. We're obligated to keep them all anyway. But what is the difference? So some said maybe these were just really important mitzvot. Don't kill, don't steal, keep Shabbat, believe in God, right? These are really important. And so such important laws, though that's what the Ten Commandments are. In a sense, the Ten Commandments are not, you know, more important than other laws, but they're pretty important. There was actually a time when, the Talmud quotes this, that the Ten Commandments were recited daily in the synagogue. It was in the Siddur, it was in the prayer book, and every day they would read Ten Commandments. There then was the problem that people were starting to say, you know what, I'll keep the Ten Commandments, be a good Jew, but the other 603, you know, God gave us the Ten Commandments, but the other ones, you know, whatever. So because of that, there was this movement away from making a big deal about the Ten Commandments, because of this concern that people would maybe associate too much with it. Maybe that's a reference to Christianity. It's unclear exactly, but that was a little bit of a concern. So, but it could be that that's what it is, that they are the really important or central mitzvot in the Torah. Some suggest that they're actually categories, that with those 10 commandments can actually be broken down into categories, and you can actually fit all the mitzvot into one of those 10 categories. And maybe that's what it was. It was kind of God was giving us the category, saying, hey, I'm going to teach you the whole 613 mitzvot. But he said it in shorthand by telling us these 10. And one other possibility, this one I think is kind of interesting, is that when a person comes to convert, Today we generally require more for conversion just because of the nature of modern society, right? We don't live in Jewish communities in the way that it used to be, where there was real obligation to follow whatever the community said, right? We're now citizens of the state. We're not citizens of the Jewish community. So it's a little bit different nowadays, but historically you were just a citizen of the Jewish governance in whatever place you lived. The law basically was that when a person came to convert, you didn't need to necessarily tell them all the mitzvot. You would tell them, someone said, I want to convert. You would tell them a couple hard, a couple easy. You would give them a sense about what the Torah is entailed. And if they say, hey, you know what? You told me some really hard ones. You told me some really easy ones. You told me that people tend to not like Jews. And you know what? I want it anyway. So if a person makes that commitment, so then you would you'd convert them. And they would end up keeping all the mitzvot because they'd be members of the community. And there'd be really no choice for them not to. And so they would just learn and they would do it as they saw. So one suggestion is maybe that's what these Ten Commandments were, right? It's mixot kalot, mixot chamorot. It was a little easy, a little hard of the commandments, and it was more just a selection for the Jews to say, okay, right? Because in a sense, we all converted at Har Sinai to Judaism. And so in a sense, that was a part of our conversion process. The laws of conversion are learned from what the Torah says happened at Har Sinai. So it could be that that's where that law comes from, is that that's what the Ten Commandments really were. In any case, there are Ten Commandments, but ultimately there is this tradition, as we just read, of 613 commandments. They're broken down in different ways. Man versus man versus God. Some say that's the distinction between the first tablet and the second tablet. The first tablet tends to be between more man and God. The second tablet, man and man. The one possible exception to that rule is maybe the last of the first five, which is honor your father and your mother, but some say no, God is also included in that, meaning the creation of child is, you know, not just by man and woman, but also by God, and so in a sense, respecting your parents is a way of respecting God as well. Whatever the case may be, you know, whether that really is or is not the distinction, right, there certainly we do see that distinction, and one of the other important distinctions, and that's what we saw quoted in source number one, is that some of them are positive, some of them are things that we are obligated to do, and some are negative, not bad, but meaning negative in the sense that these are the things you are not allowed to do, right? The thou shalt and the thou shalt nots. Now, what's interesting is that that distinction isn't just a conceptual distinction between the laws, like, oh, just like a way in our mind to kind of think about them. No, there's actually ramifications to whether a mitzvah is a thou shalt or whether a mitzvah is a thou shalt not. One example difference is if a person is destitute, to what extent does a person need to expend money in order to fulfill a mitzvah? So if it's a mitzvah that you must do, so sometimes there's limits, and say, you know, a person only has to spend up to 20% of their funds in order to do a mitzvah. And so if a person is really destitute, it's okay, so they won't shake the lulav, they can't afford it. And that's just what it is, right? They're not obligated to do the mitzvah if doing that mitzvah will cost them more than 20%. There's some exceptions to that, but generally, when it comes to a negative mitzvah, you know, don't kill, you'd have to spend all your money in the world to get out of transgressing that mitzvah. So that's one, let's say, distinction about, you know, how far does the obligation go. If it's something that you're prohibited from doing, you have to go to all measures in order to not do it. When it comes to something you're obligated to do, sometimes there's, you know, a point where you say, you know what, you're patur, you're not obligated to go all the way. Another place that there is an important distinction is sometimes between men and women. There's mitzvot aseh. Not all mitzvot aseh, not all positive commandments, but certain positive commandments that are time-bound, the Talmud teaches women aren't obligated to keep. So, now it's not all time, the Talmud goes through them, each one, there's certain time-bound positive commandments that women are obligated to do, like Shabbat, meaning even the positive things on Shabbat, like Kiddush, and so on. But generally speaking, time-bound positive commandments women aren't obligated to do, so that would be one kind of distinction, right? But when it comes to negative commandments, you know, it's like women can go murder, right? That's going to be on everybody that to be prohibited from doing. Okay. And fine, so that's some of the issue with positive and negative commandments. There's other, sometimes different factors involved in them, but I think that's enough for now. Now, one of the interesting things is sometimes in the Torah you find mitzvot mentioned before Har Sinai. Easy example, last week's Torah portion, what mitzvah did we learn about? Brit Milah, circumcision. And yet, right? So that becomes kind of this interesting thing of what's the significance of mitzvot in the Torah that appear before Har Sinai, mitzvot in the Torah that appear after Har Sinai. And of course, then there's also the issue of the seven Noahide laws, which are considered to be kind of laws in the Bible that all peoples of the world are obligated to keep. Right? Only Jews are obligated to do things in such great detail and such an extensive assortment of commandments. But everybody in the world needs to do certain basic laws. So some of this, the Talmud has a whole discussion on how do you kind of figure out what these different things are. Typically you find a mitzvah, which is repeated after Har Sinai again, is a sign that that mitzvah is only obligatory to Jews. If it's not repeated after Har Sinai, then it's understood that that also applies to Gentiles. Typically, the mitzvot are all repeated again after Har Sinai. But what's interesting about this is the fact that certain mitzvot are referenced earlier in the Torah means that these were things that were performed, activities that were performed before there was a Torah, before there was a Har Sinai, right? So, right, biblical scholars love this kind of stuff, right? Biblical historians, because they say, oh, you know, the Jews just borrowed what the Mesopotamians did in, you know, in their lands, and we just took those laws and added other laws and called it Judaism. But really, Judaism is just a Middle Eastern, you know, kind of religion. And so the answer to that question is, that's right. Meaning, the Rambam would love that, and he would basically say, and this is something that we find, we saw when it came to sacrifices and so on, kind of this notion that we're going to adopt, maybe it'll be incorporated into the Torah, certain practices that were done by other peoples, but we're going to do it a little differently. And it's that difference which is the big deal. Rabbi Angel spoke about this past Shabbat, when it came to Brit Milah, that the practice in the Middle Eastern lands of those who practice circumcision, there were other peoples that did it, was to always circumcise a child at the age of 13, meaning moving into manhood, right? Jews came along and said, no, you do it at the age of 8 days. And the difference is significant, because when you do it at the age of 13, it's a coming of age ceremony. Perhaps it signifies, you know, don't engage in sexual pleasures too much. Perhaps is the idea that you're going through puberty. We want to limit it. But when Jews do it, it has nothing to do with that. It's just about identity. Right? It's just about Jewish identity. And so, to some extent, by taking activities that people were familiar with already, but changing them, the Torah was able to teach really important lessons and teach really important values to the Jewish people. And so it could be with certain mitzvot. That's kind of what's going on with them. And there's other examples you find in the Torah. Yibum is performed, right? Levirate marriage is performed by Yehuda. But Yehuda has Yibum with his daughter-in-law. In the laws of the Torah, that would never be allowed, right? It's only a brother with a sister-in-law. So certain things maybe were done, but then they change in the Torah. And the change is often what's significant, you know, is the significance. Okay. Okay, now this becomes interesting. Now, obviously, if a mitzvah is written in the Torah, so we'll say, you know what, that mitzvah is biblical, right? It says it in the Torah. Okay, that's the law of the Torah. There's another kind of law, which we consider to be biblical, that does not appear anywhere in the Torah at all. And that category is called Halakha LeMoshe MiSinai, a law from Moshe at Sinai. There are certain laws the Talmud records that they say this law was just communicated to Moshe orally from God with no textual basis for it at all. But it was told to Moshe at Har Sinai, and so that law has the status of a biblical law. Now, there aren't very many of them, but there is a smattering of them. Right? One of the famous halakha Moshe Sinai is the way that we make tefillin, phylacteries. Right? Nowhere in the Torah does it say they need to be square. Nowhere does it say they need to be black. The Talmud says that's halakha Moshe Sinai, that's how they're supposed to be made. And so there's a couple laws that are considered to be that. Those are going to be considered to be biblical laws. Those were said directly to Moshe. There's a very old tradition about them, right? You find them in the Dead Sea Scroll, Qumran caves, you find tefillin and things. Very, very old. They're considered to be back to the times of the giving of the Torah. And so those are going to have a status of biblical law as well. Okay, so those would be kind of be the immediate categories, the easy categories of biblical law, things that are explicitly in the Torah, or things that we have a tradition that go back to Moshe at Har Sinai. Those things are going to be biblical law as well. Sometimes the Talmud will have a whole debate, you know. They know that there's a law. This is what Jews have always practiced, and they'll wonder, how do we know this law? So they'll quote one verse, and another rabbi will say, nah, it can't be that verse. That's not it. Someone will quote another verse and say, ah, it can't be it. Another rabbi, nah, that verse can't be it. Finally, another rabbi will come in and will say, no, I have a tradition. This is halakha l'Moshe Sinai. And everyone will say, okay, let's move on to the next subject. Meaning, case closed, that's what it is. But the point is, the reason they're searching for the verse is because it's so clear to them that this is the law. This is just what we've been doing for hundreds of years. Sometimes when something is so old, they're going to search for the verse because there must be a verse for it. So someone else comes in and says, no, I actually have a tradition that there isn't a verse, but this is the halakha anyway. So that falls into that category. And that's a small category of mitzvot. Okay. The other interesting kind of source when it comes to biblical law, but they're not really biblical laws, are mitzvot that are learned out from the post-Chumash books of the Bible. So things that are written in Nevi'im, in prophets, or in Tuvim, in writings. Those also, one would might say, those are biblical laws. They're typically not referred to as biblical laws. We call them Divrei Kabbalah. Not Kabbalah like, ooh, Kabbalah. But Kabbalah means things that we have a tradition about. That certain times something is based on a verse in prophets. That's not going to have the status of biblical law. At the end of the day, we'll probably call that rabbinic law. But that's like a really important biblical law. Sometimes there are some differences between Divrei Kabbalah and Dinei Derabbanan, even though, generally speaking, they're all considered to be rabbinic laws. Now, just one example is on source number 2. I quoted this in a class I gave last night, so it was on my mind. And this is taken from Yeshayahu, and it says, "If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the Lord honorable, and shall honor him, not doing your own ways, nor finding your own pleasures, nor speaking your own words." So it talks about that on Shabbat, you should not go your own ways, you should not speak your own words. From here, the rabbis teach, you see that on Shabbat, one should speak differently, one should walk differently, right? One shouldn't run on Shabbat, you should only walk. One shouldn't speak of things on Shabbat that you can't do on Shabbat. So, for example, a person, right, this is the source of the idea that you can't ask a Gentile to do something for you. There's other issues that we'll talk about a little bit later, but one of the issues that you're not allowed to even ask it is because this idea that you can't say, please turn on a light, because you've just spoken about something that you're not allowed to do, right? And that goes against what this verse says about Daber Davar, right? That a person's speech on Shabbat should be different than it is during the week. So, right, this is something that we would call Din Kabbalah. It's not a biblical law, but it's inspired by perhaps a biblical verse, or it has rooting within a verse in the rest of the Bible. But we kind of still call it rabbinic law. And sometimes you'll have some, even in the Talmud, the rabbis will say something based on a biblical verse, and sometimes the commentators will say, you know what, even though they quoted a biblical verse, the biblical verse doesn't really mean that. They're just using it as a smachta, something to kind of, you know, they see it kind of as a hint towards it, but it's not considered to be a biblical law. And that is often not clear. Is it biblical or is it not? So that'll be a little bit of a discussion. But generally speaking, something's written in the Bible, that's going to be considered to be a law, a biblical law. And we'll talk about it in a little bit later. Who cares? What's the difference? You're obligated to follow the laws anyway. So we'll get to that. Okay. Let's move on. Further, any questions?
Yes.
Yes. No, generally we do follow them. If you can find something in prophets that say something, so, you know, it's often taken seriously. Now, we'll see why in a second, why it doesn't mean it has to be the law. Just because something's in prophets doesn't necessarily mean it has to become the law. As we'll see, maybe that's what they thought in that generation, but the rabbis of a different generation felt differently. We'll talk about that a little bit in a moment and more next week. But certainly if something is in the prophets, right, that is a strong suggestion that perhaps that is something we should be doing, right, if it appears in the prophets, okay? But it's not necessarily obligatory the way that it would be if it appears in Chumash, okay? So, but there's a Kabbalah, there's a very old tradition that this is something that we should be doing, even though it's not necessarily something we have to be doing, as far as biblical laws are, we have to, as far as rabbinic law. But again, we'll talk about that. Okay, so what's rabbinic law? This is something we're really going to talk about more next week, but it's important just to, in order to get to this next part of the question, which is finding out what's really included within biblical law, within the rules of the Torah. So when we talk about rabbinic laws, there's two categories. There's takanot and gezerot. There's takanot, which are enactments, Chanukah, Purim, right? Those are takanot. And you have gezerot, fences, where something is not prohibited in the Torah, but the rabbis say, don't do that, because if you do that, you may come to transgress a biblical law. Okay? And we'll talk about next week what gives them the right, what's the authority, why do we have to listen, right, and so on and so forth. But that's rabbinic law. That's a small, it's not a huge category of laws. If I ask you to list me takanot, so you come up with so many, you're not going to come up with hundreds and hundreds of takanot and gezerot. It's not a huge portion. Most of the Talmud is not takanot and gezerot. Most of the Talmud is not biblical law either, meaning explicit quoting psukim. So what is the Talmud? There's a huge category that we need to talk about and identify what exactly that is. And that's a category called the drashot, the interpretations, or the biblical exegesis, right? Where the Torah says one thing, and we interpret it, and use that interpretation to develop additional details, or additional laws as part of the Torah. If you look at source number 3, and I need to read through it, source number 3 is very old. It goes back to the halachic midrashim, the midrash halakha, which we spoke about in the summer course. This goes back to the 2nd, 3rd century of the Common Era. This is from the times of the Mishnah, so it's very early, where Rabbi Yishmael, one of the great sages, lists 13 principles, 13 rules that governed how one could interpret a biblical verse. When one looks at the Torah, things are very vague. Keep Shabbat. Right? Keep kashrut. Right? Meaning, we don't necessarily have all the details there. But using these principles, we're able to tease out the laws. We're able to figure out what the rules should be. And the idea is that these rules, like if I were to write I work for the military, and I want to send you a message encoded. But I also get to you the tools that help you to decode the message as well, so that you can read it. Right? So these are the decoding instructions. Right? God gave us the Bible, and He gave us decoding instructions, or rules. He's the author, and He says, when you read this book, these rules should tell you how it is to read these laws. And so when I say something like this, it tells you that. And when I say something that way, it tells you this. Right? And just the rules about how you go ahead and read it.
Are we saying these 13 rules are in the Torah?
Are what? They don't appear in Tanakh. The rules themselves don't appear in Tanakh. Right? These rules are going to be based on a tradition, right, back to Moshe. Right? That these are the rules, these are the methods of interpretation.
So you could go through the Talmud and say, oh, this section is using this method.
Right. Now part of the problem.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of them are not, you know, they just kind of make sense. We'll look at a couple in a little bit. To some extent, though, sometimes we don't really know how all of them work, right? Which makes it difficult. That's why, to some extent, we don't really do this anymore, right? We don't look back in a biblical verse and say, okay, I'm going to apply a klal uprat over here and figure out what the law should be, right? To some extent, we've maybe lost the knowledge of exactly how to use these rules. And to some extent, right, that, now we'll see why that's significant and why that's really kind of insignificant at this point. I'll get to that a little bit later, right? So there are these rules. Now, there's an old debate about these rules. Now, the majority of the Talmud is actually made up of these drashot, these exegesis, these interpretations of the psukim using these principles in order to tease out the laws, right? In order to understand what the text of the Torah is really saying. And there's implications in the Torah that there must be other things going on over here. Because let's say it comes to Shabbat, it says keep Shabbat. It mentions a couple things that are prohibited. But only a couple things that are prohibited, and yet then we then have the case of the person who gathers the things up on Shabbat, and he gets punished for it. But nor does the Torah say you're not allowed to carry on Shabbat. So it must be that there are things that are also prohibited, that the Torah didn't say explicitly, but are included in these prohibitions, right? And those things we know through these drashot, through these interpretations. Now there is actually an old debate, though, about drashot. Meaning, and this is a question about, you know, where exactly do they come from? Do they come from Moshe at Har Sinai? And here I don't mean the principles, but I mean the application of the principles. Meaning, did Moshe know all the laws in the Talmud at Har Sinai? Meaning, and the rabbis are just basically stating a tradition? Or are they something that the rabbis came up with over the millennia? Okay, that's a bit debate. According to the Gaonim, according to the rabbis from the area of Babylonia, they said, "What are you talking about? Meaning, of course, everything goes back to Har Sinai, and the rabbis are just quoting traditions. Because if you say that, meaning it must be that that's the case. The Rambam, Maimonides, says." That's not really true. Meaning, they basically say, according to the Gaonim, we have these drashot, and we're using the drashot simply to give support for laws that we already know to be the case. Right? That's what the drashot are there for. We know these laws already. It's not like the rabbis sat down and said, oh, hey, let's do this, look at this one. We could read this pasuk this way, and all of a sudden, hey, we have a new law to announce that we figured out last night. No, all the laws were known already, and the drashot just come to give support to laws that we already knew, right? But that the drashot themselves aren't creating the laws. The laws were already given to Moshe. Already Moshe knew this is how you read the pasuk. This is what the law is, and he taught the people that. And we came along later and brought drashot to show where does that law originally come from. The Rambam says it's not true. He says it's not true. He says if you say that, then what do you make of all the debates in the Talmud? There's debates in the Talmud about what the law should be. So what are you saying then? You're saying that really we originally knew the law and it must be we forgot and now we're having a debate about it, what it was. He says, that's terrible. He says, that means our whole tradition is broken, has fallen apart, and he really doesn't like saying that. The Gaonim might say, yeah, we're having debates to figure out what originally had been taught. The Rambam doesn't like that. He says, he finds that to be very troubling, that notion. And he in fact says, it's not true. He says, not everything was taught to Moshe at Har Sinai. The only thing that Moshe was taught at Har Sinai were, he was given the Bible, he was given these specific laws, these laws given to Moshe at Har Sinai, and he was given the rules for interpretation. But then, it was up to the sages to sit down and to apply those rules and to figure out what the laws should be. And sometimes there's debate about how exactly a law should be applied, which rules should be applied in order to derive a law. And so because of that, there ends up being debates in the Talmud. Because it really is a debate. And it's a true debate. And according to the Rambam, in a certain sense, when you have a debate, it's not that one person is right and one person is wrong. Really, both of them are right. But because they're both using a drasha, they're both using a legitimate method of interpretation, but we have another rule in the Torah that says you have to follow the majority rule, and so that's ultimately, we conclude according to one interpretation, but it's not that we said that that rabbi was wrong, this rabbi was right, really they're both right. According to the Gaonim, one is right and one is wrong, meaning there was the law, and now they're trying to figure out what it was, and one of them is correct and one isn't correct. So a bit of debate about what exactly is going on with these drashot, but at the end of the day, right, they all fundamentally, though, say, right, these drashot are really important. They're the ones that govern how we interpret the Torah. Now, this group of laws is the major group of laws, and this becomes an interesting question of how do you define these laws? On one hand, they're based on biblical verses, which might make you want to say this is a biblical law. On the other hand, it's based on the rabbi's reading of that verse, so you might want to say that's a rabbinic law. So which one is it? So let's look the following source. This is source number 4. This is the Rambam on the laws of marriage. And he says the following. He says, the process of acquisition fulfills one of the Torah's positive commandments. Acquisition meaning marriage. Right? Getting married is a positive commandment in the Torah. The process of acquiring a wife is formalized in 3 ways. Through the transfer of money, through the transfer of formal document, and through sexual relations. Meaning, you have 3 options as ways to get married. You can have sex, you can make a contractual obligation, or you can give money. Today, which way do we do it? No? We do the first. We only do transfer of money. Right? The rabbis in the Talmud already said, you don't use sex to get married. That's completely inappropriate. So that was put out. And even using a contract, ketuvah is obligations that you have in a marriage. But it doesn't actually create the marriage. We create the marriage through the transfer of money. That's what the ring is, right? You give the ring, the woman accepts the ring, and through that, the marriage is affected. Okay. Now let's keep reading. It says, the effectiveness of sexual relations and the transfer of formal document have their origin in the Torah itself. I mean, those are biblical laws. While the effectiveness of the transfer of money is rabbinic in origin, divrei sofrim. Right, that's how he refers to it. He refers to it as divrei sofrim, which is amazing then, meaning that basically what this seems to be saying is that at the end of the day, the way that we do marriage today means that all of us are only married rabbinically. According to biblical law, we're not married. Seems pretty shocking, right? That would be the situation. So the Kesef Mishnah, who is the Beit Yosef, who is Rabbi Yosef Kaira, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, in his commentary on the Rambam, says, whoa, what is going on over here? He says, it's very perplexing that he wrote that money is rabbinic in origin, for it is learned from a Gezerah Shavah. That's one of the rules from the previous page. And anything learned from one of the 13 principles is considered biblical. Okay. Give me a moment, okay? What is the Gezerah Shavah for marriage through money? So it's based on the following thing. It says the source for marriage in the Torah is the following. It says, Ki Yika Ish Isha. When a man takes a woman. Okay? Ki Yika Ish Isha. There is another verse in the Torah I think it's in next week's parasha, that says, Natati Kesef Hasadeh Kach Mimeni. I've given money for the field, take it from me. Anybody know what that's a reference to? I've given money for the field, take it from me. Abraham buying Marat HaMachpelah. Okay, the cave. So the Talmud in Kiddushin, the dealing with it, says, Gzerah Shavah says, if you find a similar word in two verses, it tells you that the two verses are connected. And so here it says, Ki Yikach, when a man takes a woman, and here in reference to the giving of money, it also uses the language of Kach. So from here we learn that Kach, taking, is a word which is used in reference to money. So here when it says a man takes a woman, you see that also that can be done through the giving of money as well.
Seems like that's such a common word. Is it really not common?
So Gzerah Shavah, the Talmud actually has a discussion, Rashi mentions this, that it could be when it comes to specific Gzerah Shavah, that there's more tradition based on, meaning that it's not just anywhere it says Kach, but we have a tradition that these two Kachs are connected, and the rabbis of the Talmud figure out what the connection is. Because you're right, in theory then it says the word Et all over the place. So,
Gzerah Shavah. There are examples where it's really an unusual word, it happens twice. But this.
We do it between Pesach and Sukkot. It says Tedvav, the 15th by Sukkot, it says the 15th by Pesach. We learn from there laws, you know, between Pesach and Sukkot based on that. So we find Gzerah Shavah is kind of different because it's not logical completely, it's just kind of, we have this tradition. I mean, the logic in it is that if a word is used in one way to mean one thing, it means it's someplace else, but something like Gzerah Shavah don't have anything to do with it. It has the same word, so we just apply laws by one case to laws by the other case. People ask a question, we learn marriage through buying burial plots. I'll let you think about the meaning of that. In any case, so yes.
So if
it's actually really beautiful intuition. I heard about that. But
if anyway, sexual relations isn't one of the conditions of being married in this case, why do we have yichud?
So again, it may be a sign of marriage, meaning that is, there's two stages in marriage in the Bible. There's kiddushin and nisuin, right? There's kiddushin, which is where you're bound together, but nisuin is when the marriage is completed. I mean, some people used to do kiddushin, wait a year, and then do nisuin.
Right?
So you would be married, but the girl would still live in her father's home, and then you would have nisuin a year later. That would affect. So the yichud is the nisuin, right? You're completing that process. Some say even under the chuppah you're already doing the nisuin, really at the same time that you're doing the kiddushin, but the giving of the money is the kiddushin. So he says, it's based on one of these principles, and he says, anything based on a principle is actually a biblical law. That's the stat, meaning it's just, we have rules that tell us how to read the Bible. So if those rules bring out particular laws, those laws are going to be considered to be biblical laws. So he says, why is the Rambam referred to it as Divrei Sofrim? So it's a little bit difficult. It could be the Rambam maybe does have a little bit of a different opinion, but he actually answers, he says, no, he says the words of the sages, just because it was the sages that did the interpretation. But it's also considered to be a biblical law. It's a little bit of a stretch within the words of the Rambam itself, perhaps, but the position that Rabbi Yosef Kaira quotes is, whether or not it's a position of the Rambam, it is the overwhelming position of the rabbis, of most rabbinic authorities in the Middle Ages, that anything based on a biblical interpretation using one of these principles is considered to be a biblical law. So when we talk about 613 laws, we're talking about 613 perhaps explicit laws. But when we talk about biblical law, we're talking about a huge portion. And that means that as far as we're concerned, when we talk about, oh, this is a rabbinic law, we're talking about a very small portion of the laws. When we talk about biblical law really is the major portion of laws in our tradition. And then we have some rabbinic laws. I'm not saying that they're nothing, but they're 20%, right? 80% are your biblical laws. It means the overall majority of what the Talmud says, as far as we're concerned, is a biblical law because it's interpretation of a biblical verse. Yes?
Maybe it's just because I go to a conservative synagogue, but I always thought it was the other way around completely. Because
it's called the Talmudic.
You know, because the rabbis, you know, the sacrifices, all that stuff is gone. The establishment of the synagogue, you know, and
again, certain practices we have today maybe aren't biblical, maybe don't fall into this category, right? But again, there are things that have been enacted or customs that we're going to have classes on customs. There are many things. In some ways, our lives are very different today than they were 2,000 years ago. But when it comes to hard and fast laws, most of the laws are biblical, are based on biblical verse. But you're right. Some of the way the Jewish community functions today and things like that, they might not even be rabbinic laws. They might be customs. Not that customs aren't significant. We'll talk about customs when we get to that. But the point is that when it comes to real laws, when it comes to what are the laws for keeping Shabbat, those are biblical laws. Those aren't rabbinic laws, despite the fact that they're based on rabbinic interpretation. As far as we're concerned, that's a biblical law. And it has ramifications. Meaning, we believe we're obligated to follow what rabbinic law also, which we'll talk about next week, why that is. So at the end of the day, we're obligated to keep either. But it actually is significant whether something is a biblical law or a rabbinic law, as far as certain scenarios. That's what I want to talk about now for a moment. Yeah? Okay. What's just interesting, and it's late, I don't have so much time to get into all of this, but there's actually, you know, a story about, I think I mentioned this in the summer course, where Moshe goes up to get the Torah. And the story goes that he sees that on the letters of the Torah, these little crowns. You ever seen a Torah? There's little crowns. And he says, what are these crowns? And he says, oh, in the future, there's going to be Rabbi Akiva. He's going to interpret those crowns. Moshe says, I got to see this. All of a sudden, Moshe's sitting in the back row of Rabbi Akiva's class. And here's Rabbi Akiva talking about stuff. And Moshe's sitting there. He says, I have no idea what's going on. And he's completely distressed. He says, what is this? Like, this is not my religion. This is not my Jew Torah. This is not the Torah. And then, you know, someone asks a question. He says, oh, Rabbi Akiva, how do we know this law? And Rabbi Akiva says, oh, this is Halakha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, meaning probably not one of the literal, meaning one of the interpretations. And all of a sudden, he says, oh, Moshe feels so much better. And he's whisked back, you know, to Har Sinai. And, you know, the basic idea is that even what Rabbi Akiva said in his Beit Midrash, it's rooted in what Moshe was given Har Sinai, meaning it's still going to be considered to be one of Moses' laws as well. So when we talk about Mosaic law, it includes Drashot as well. What's ironic is that because of this, in theory, according to this, let's say at least this approach of the Rambam, that Drashot happen over time, you actually can have a situation where you could have a biblical law which is more recent than a rabbinic law. Because imagine that 200 years after Moshe, the rabbis make an enactment. And 400 years later, they interpret a biblical verse. So that interpretation is going to be considered a biblical law, but it only sort of came into being after a rabbinic law had been made. Right? So we talk about biblical rabbinic law, you can't just think of it as, oh, there was the Bible and then it was the rabbis. It's kind of mixed together. Really, it's more about not a historical thing, but more about a status distinction, which is important to think about. So what's the difference? What's the difference? So obligation, probably not much of a difference, as we'll see next week. We'll talk about rabbinic laws next week. But for all intents and purposes, we're obligated to keep rabbinic laws. You know, you have to keep Chanukah just like you have to keep Shabbat. But there are some differences. One of the differences is how the laws change. And this is an important source. So let's look at this source over here. Source number 6. This is the Rambam dealing with kind of the rules about how legal decisions are made. And he says, when using one of the principles of exegesis, meaning a drasha, most of the Talmud, the Supreme Sanhedrin derived the law through their perception of the matter and adjudicated a case accordingly. I mean, they figured it out, they interpreted it, and arrived at their conclusion. And afterwards, what if this happens? What if then afterwards another court, meaning 50 years later, another Sanhedrin arose, and they perceived another rationale on which basis they would revoke the previous ruling? So the rabbis 50 years ago said, this is how you interpret the verse. The rabbis today say, nah, they're wrong. This is how you interpret the verse. They're both biblical laws, right? But they say, this is what we think the biblical law should be. They may revoke it and rule according to their perception. It's okay. Why? This is reflected by Deuteronomy that says to the judge who will be in that age. This indicates that a person is obligated to follow only the court in his own generation. The irony is that only applies to drashot. Now, again, one of our limitations is that we don't do drashot anymore because we're not totally sure how they work. So to some extent, we now just use the drashot that the rabbis of the Talmud shared with us. Okay, we don't necessarily go back and say, ah, I don't like the way they interpreted that verse, I'm going to interpret differently, because we don't really know how the interpretations work so well, right? And so until we have a collective Jewish court, again, that would do that, we kind of just use the drashot of the court. But at least conceptually, the biblical laws could change quite easily. As we're going to see next week, rabbinic laws are a lot harder to change. You cannot just, you know, a court 50 years later can't simply say, you know, we don't like that enactment of the earlier court, we're uprooting it. They didn't necessarily have that authority. When it came to biblical laws, they had greater authority to do that. It's ironic, and part of the reason is probably based on what we were talking about before, is that if rabbinic laws could be changed so easily, probably people would never do them in the first place. Because they would just be like, eh, you know, whatever. The rabbi said it this week, next week the rabbi's going to say something else. You know, so with biblical laws, where there's great sense of reverence, the biblical law, so even with that shifting, people would still follow. Rabbinic laws, they're much more hardened. Again, we'll talk about that next week. So that's an important difference. Another important difference is in a case of doubt. What if a person's not sure? Did I do that mitzvah? I can't remember. So if it's a biblical law, you got to do it again. If it's a rabbinic law, you don't have to do it. So, the great example are, there's two brachot. Well, I'll talk about one. There's two brachot in the Torah. Brachot that are considered to be biblical obligation. Most other brachot, most other blessings are considered to be rabbinic laws. I apologize, I'm going over. I won't be insulted if anyone needs to leave. I'll probably need another 5 minutes. One of those biblical laws, well, there's two. One is making the blessing over the Torah before one studies Torah. Birkot HaTorah. That's a biblical law. The other biblical law is doing Birkat HaMazon. Benching, right? Saying the grace after meals. That's a biblical law. The verse is V'achalta, V'savata, U'beirachta. You ate, and you were satisfied, and you blessed. Right? So it's a biblical obligation to make Birkat HaMazon after one eats. But all the blessings we make before we eat, those are rabbinic. Those are rabbinic. And there's reasons for it, and they help us focus, and the Gemara says if you don't make a blessing, it's as if you're stealing from God, right? There's all these things, but it's a rabbinic law. We're obligated. It's a rabbinic law. Fine, we're obligated in rabbinic laws too. What's the difference? What if I start eating my apple and I say, I'm not sure. I mean, if I know I didn't make a blessing, of course I have to make the blessing over the apple. But if I say, you know, I just can't remember. I think I made the blessing. I just don't remember. You would say, you know what? Don't make the blessing. Go ahead and do it. Because saying a blessing when you're not obligated to is a problem. Are you taking God's name in vain? So if you're not sure, don't do it. But if you're not sure, did I say Birkat HaMazon? Then you would have to do it. Because that, when you have a doubt about a biblical law, you're obligated to fulfill it. When you have a doubt about a rabbinic law, you're not obligated to, right? So that was kind of one of the things that the rabbis made a law. And they said, you know what? We're obligating you to do this. But if you think you did it, then that's enough, right? But if you're not sure if you did a biblical law, what God told you to do, doesn't. Then you got to make sure that you do it. And there's distinctions also when it comes to laws of Shabbat as well. I spoke about this last night when it came to asking someone who's not Jewish to help you do something on Shabbat. So whether you're asking them to transgress a biblical law, what for you would be a biblical law, or you're asking a non-Jew to transgress what for you would be a rabbinic law, actually has a distinction if there's other factors involved in that situation. So I can't get into all of the details right now, but if you're asking, right, as we saw before, asking a non-Jew to do something for you on Shabbat is a transgression because you're not allowed to say something. You can't tell someone, please turn on a light, because you're not allowed to say something on Shabbat that you're not allowed to do on Shabbat, right? That's based on that verse in Isaiah. But we said that's a rabbinic law. So if you're asking a non-Jew to do something that for yourself would only be a rabbinic law. So you basically, one thing you're not allowed to do rabbinically is ask them to do it. The other thing rabbinic is the prohibition of you to do it yourself. So in that situation where you have a rabbinic on a rabbinic, in a situation where there's then a real reason to do it because someone's sick or there's a special mitzvah that needs to be fulfilled or so on, one is allowed to just do it. So for example, if you need you have an elderly person, right? So that's for the sake of someone who's sick. And let's say pushing an elevator button, let's say assuming that's a rabbinic prohibition to push a rabbinic elevator button, so you can't do it yourself, but it would only be rabbinic if you did it, only. And asking that doorman to do it for you is a rabbinic prohibition. So in that situation, an elderly person could feel comfortable asking the doorman, please push the elevator button for me. But if it was a biblical prohibition to push that elevator button, that'd be a totally different scenario, then that wouldn't necessarily apply. In any case, I don't want to get into all the laws of that, but the point is that whether something is rabbinic or biblical will make a difference, let's say, sometimes with other scenarios. So as far as our obligation to keep the laws, it's not going to make a difference. But sometimes there are some ramifications in times that we used to have punishment. Sometimes punishments for rabbinic laws could be different than biblical laws. But in any case, so that's that issue. I want to kind of conclude by saying biblical law is obviously, when we think of Torah, DNA Torah, right, we think of them as the most important, the most significant of the laws. Ironically, in some sense, they're more flexible of the laws, at least conceptually. Practically, we don't do drashot anymore, and so they're fixed as well. We spend our time more interpreting what the interpretations mean. Right, we look at the Talmud and we say, "Oh, they interpret the verse that way. What does that interpretation mean?" Right, we don't go back to the biblical verse now and say, "What does the biblical verse mean?" We more just want to know, "What did Rav Ashi mean when he said this interpretation?" So, to some extent, they're a little more fixed now. But conceptually, there was the literal interpretation reading of the verse that was fixed. Obviously, it says, "Don't eat pig." You can't go ahead and say, "Well, no, we're going to," right? That's explicit. But when it came to some of the additional interpretations based on the exegesis, conceptually that would just be each baked in, or every Sanhedrin in each generation would engage the psukim and interpret. Typically, they would probably do what the rabbis in the previous generation thought, because why would they necessarily interpret differently? We have rules. Once in a while, they might think that, you know what, actually a rule should be applied a little bit differently, and they had the right to do so. So that's kind of the irony of laws of Torah. What one thing just kind of comes out about this today is why sometimes it's important to ask rabbis questions, because asking a rabbi, what's the biblical law, what's the rabbinic law, a rabbi won't necessarily be so interested in answering, because we're obligated to keep both of them. So, you know, a person says, I want to just follow what the Torah says, and I follow what the rabbis say. It's kind of like difficult to do, because we consider most things to be biblical laws. And as we're going to see next week, we believe there's a biblical obligation to follow what the rabbis say. So it's kind of like, doesn't matter. And, you know, when someone just wants to go ahead and do that, you know, it's kind of like uncomfortable. It's like, you know, do as much as you feel comfortable with, and then that's it, you know. But to go ahead and say that I'm going to make the distinction, it's a little bit difficult sometimes to draw those distinctions. And sometimes even if you can, you don't really want to, just because of what's really the difference practically. But it is important to sometimes ask rabbi, because sometimes the distinction does make a difference into what the law should be. Meaning, so a person says, you know, I don't remember whether I did this. So you need to find out, was that a biblical law or was that a rabbinic law that I'm not sure whether I did? Right? So sometimes it's a little complicated to figure out whether something is biblical or rabbinic. That would be a scenario. When it comes to some things on Shabbat, it's important to know whether a transgression is considered biblical or is considered rabbinic. So, you know, in that regard, asking a rabbi with a lot of questions is helpful, just because these things are not so clear and requires a really good working understanding of the law to distinguish between the various, as we're going to see, we're going to be talking about biblical laws, which include exegesis, but then rabbinic laws, we're going to look at customs, we're going to look at tradition. So you have to be able to distinguish between all these different layers to sometimes render what the halachic decision should be in a specific case. So next week we're going to look at DNA Drabbanan, rabbinic laws, and I look forward to seeing you then.